Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes. My name's Tim.
And this is Chris.
This is Adam.
Today we're going to be giving our hot take on a game we just finished playing, Biohack. But before we get into that, I do have some poll results to go over. As always, on social media, I like to ask a question of our listeners, get a chance to hear some of your feedback. Now, this wasn't actually a poll. This was just a straight up question because I wanted some open-ended answers on this one. The question I asked was, are there any games that you think you would buy an expansion for without knowing anything about them? Grammatically, I don't think that's worded very well, but I think you get my meaning.
He's a Galaxy player out there.
That's right. Direwolf Studios just announced a new expansion for Clank Catacombs, designed by Paul Denon. Clank Catacombs being one of my favorite games. They haven't announced anything about it other than they showed the box cover. And I just said, I'm in on this. I was curious if other people got excited about expansions. Now, it's not across the board for me because Nucleum also had an expansion that just went to retail this week, the Australia expansion. One of my favorite games from last year. I absolutely love it. And I probably won't buy it, or at least not for a long time. And the difference for me there was just that Nucleum is a heavy game. It doesn't get to the table very often. There's still so much for me to explore in it. So I just don't feel like I need an expansion. Well, Clank Catacombs, I get to the table all the time and it just feels like add more cards, add more tiles, you know, even throw in some extra mechanisms. Give him some more spinny tiles for Adam.
It needs a big fix is what it needs. Maybe this expansion
fixes it. Yeah, the next expansion for Clank Catacombs is going to be take out the spinny tiles.
I think we can house rule that if you guys really need to. But in any case, so I got really excited about it and I was wondering how other people felt. How would you answer this? Are there games that you feel like you would buy an expansion for? Sight unseen.
Nope. That's an easy one. There was a day when I definitely would have done that. There are probably a bunch of games where I would have done that. But the longer I game, the more reluctant I feel to just buy things without knowing that they're particularly good, which is one of the reasons I don't back nearly as many Kickstarters as I used to. I kind of stick now to games that I've tried and I really enjoy. And the same goes for expansions. I've got to know something about it. I mean, even if it's a game that I love, then, you know, I have to know something. And as I'm saying this, I could maybe picture the one game where I would get an expansion regardless, possibly Tapestry, just because there's been such a long history of good expansions on that game. And I know that'll never happen because I think they're done doing expansions for Tapestry.
Well, you know, aside from the ones I've mentioned, there are a couple games, and actually, Chris, it's interesting because Tapestry is one of the games that I would probably buy an expansion for sight unseen. Apiary has a new expansion announced, and there's something about those games. You can just add more variability and more variety without greatly changing the mechanisms. And I feel like that's what's going to happen if we get expansions for those games. But on the other hand, games like Everdell, which you would think, hey, they just need to add more variety in the decks, but they instead, the expansions are pretty hit and miss for me. Some of them I liked what they added, but you can't mix them all together. So adding more expansions, you kind of then have to pick and choose what you're going to play with. Terraforming Mars is another great example. It should have been so easy. All they had to do was add more variety in the decks. And Prelude did a great job of adding something that just made the game flow. But the other expansions all felt like they bloated them in strange ways. And so I usually will not just buy an expansion without knowing anything about it. And Clank Catacombs, we'll see how that one goes. I think I will buy it and we'll see. I'll have to report back and let you know if it was a good choice or a bad choice.
So I've had periods where, like Chris was saying, I've had periods where, oh my gosh, I need to get the expansion for that game. I love this game so much. I'm going to get it. Dune Imperium, maybe when Immortality or Rise of Ix. Is that right?
Rise of Ix? Was the first one.
Sounds like a Star Wars name now that I'm saying in my head. Yeah. So when Rise of Ix came out, you know, I took a look at it. Oh, I need to get that one. And then Immortality. Yeah, I got to get that one too for completion's sake. But I've been burned on some of these expansions. The Barrage one, I'm not too keen on that. It, you know, adds this Dutch orange faction and some weird other little funky things. I just like the base game and the tightness of that. I just got the Seekers and Outcasts for Eclipse. While I'm excited to play those, the base game is so good. I don't even know if I need these guys. And then the production's all weird. So they kind of messed up with the production on that. On these expansions. This is a little side note here, but they didn't wash the figures. They didn't do a pre-wash. They forgot to do it on this first wave, so that's a bummer. And then the orbitals for one of the factions are all, they're a little bit out of scale. And then their interceptors for these guys are like super tiny and frail. So it's a weird production. I don't know what happened there. It's a little disappointing. So I had high standards, right, for the Eclipse stuff. And then since it wasn't the cream of the crop, now I'm like, ugh. But yeah, like Chris said, almost verbatim, the longer that I am involved in the hobby, the more reluctant I am to pick up an expansion for a game. I'm going to have to take a hard look at it, see what it does, and make sure I really want it before I'm going to buy it these days.
Yeah. Well, here's what some of our listeners said. So over on Patreon, Ross said, not for me. If I love a game enough that I always want more and I want to know whether the changes an expansion implements would be so drastic that they would negatively affect the experience of a favorite. If the game isn't a favorite, I want to know why, where my money is going. All that said, I did this several times with Dominion and probably will again. You know what you're going to get out of those expansions? More cards. So maybe that's cheating. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. You know, Dominion has a record of creating expansions that fit what you want in that expansion. So that's a pretty easy bet. Susan said, pretty much all of them. Alexander said, a few come to mind. Dungeon crawlers like HeroQuest that I have an insatiable appetite to consume, or those that are better left a mystery, such as Time Stories. Not all of the expansions are the best, but not every song in an album charts or every movie in some of my favorite universes scores high with critics or fans alike. When I find something I like, I want to dive in feet first and get the whole experience for good and for bad. I'm not a fan of Jar Jar, but the pod racing scene in Phantom Menace with surround sound still excites my little boy heart to this day. That's a great example. Yeah, that's interesting, right? With board games, I mean, I can see that, but again, and I have gone all in with some expansions on board games, but I don't necessarily play them all or very frequently. So, but it's kind of like a Phantom Menace. I'm glad I saw it, but I don't usually go back and revisit that one very often.
So from Phantom Menace to Star Realms, Chris, is there a Star Realms expansion that you wouldn't purchase immediately?
I'm not sure if that's a trick question or not. Probably the command decks. That's the way that you and I play all the time, yet that is not my favorite way to play. I don't love that one as much as I love just the straight game. If it wasn't for the fact that you loved it so much, I would not play it.
Okay.
But I do love playing it with you, so you know, let's keep those games going.
But let's face it, Chris, with Star Realms, every time a new digital expansion comes out, you purchase it, right? Without even looking at it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's exactly what you're doing.
Well, oh, no, that's true. I stand corrected. No, that's actually a really good point. And there is one other expansion that I never play with unless someone specifically says I want to play with that. And it's the Missions expansion, which I really just don't love.
Yeah.
Adam's giving the big thumbs down.
Thumbs down for Missions.
Over on Blue Sky, Games and Play said, I've started to avoid expansions in general, but I would buy one for Santa Monica, which is begging for one, and the Veil of Eternity. And I talked about the Veil of Eternity recently. I think it needs an expansion. I would absolutely buy an expansion for Veil of Eternity if I own that game.
I want to hear some elaboration on the Santa Monica. Why does Santa Monica need an expansion? We played that before, Tim, and what's your thoughts? Do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, probably just because I think you started to see the same cards over and over again, and I think there's an opportunity. I had seen an expansion announced for that a while back, and I remember because there was like a double wide card that had the LA Marathon finish line at Santa Monica pier in there. So I remember seeing a picture of it. I wonder if that just never got published, or maybe he's looking for another expansion. I'm not really sure. I would guess that if you play Santa Monica a lot, you're going to want to see some variety in that pretty quickly. Ryan Gilmore said, games I love with plug-and-play variability, like Heat Pedal to the Metal or Dice Throne. And again, yeah, should be a good fit, right? Just new board for Heat, or you know, some minor changes. But I think there's an opportunity for the wrong designers to get their hands in an expansion and kind of make the game different than what you're looking for. So who knows? And then over on Facebook, Omar said, sadly, I buy most expansions without knowing what's in them. I'm obsessive that way. Before we jump into Biohack, I wanted to give a quick shout out to Braden, who is one of our Patreon supporters and the winner of our Wormspan giveaway this month. Congrats, Braden. Thanks for your support, and so glad
Great. You
got that game. He's already sent me some pictures of it, said he's been having a great time playing it with his wife. It's now one of their favorite games. So
nice. I love it.
That's awesome. This month in May, we're going to be giving away the Kickstarter edition of Sleeping God's Distant Skies. So if you'd like to support the show and potentially win some great games, we'll be giving away at least one game every month to our friend of the show level supporters. But there's lots of other great stuff on our Patreon account. Vote on some content we're doing. For example, the game we played today was picked by our Patreon supporters. But also, we've been putting up some pretty fun, special, exclusive content over there as well. So check that out if you want to support the show and also get a little bit more active with us. All right, let's jump into a description of Biohack. In Biohack, you play as disgraced scientists who are trying to advance your old mentor's work in splicing DNA to create mythological creatures in an attempt to prove to the world that his work had value. Though I'm not quite sure hunting rare wildlife and playing God with their genes is going to earn you the reputation you're hoping for. You'll do this by collecting DNA in nature and then experimenting with it to create these mythical creatures, which are represented by cards in your tableau. The primary way you collect DNA is by sending workers, which happen to be androids called Nomen, out into the wild. The twist on worker placement here is that all players secretly decide where they're going to send their Nomen and reveal them at the same time. Spaces that have more workers on them will provide better benefits, so you may want to guess what your opponents want to do and follow along for the best benefits. Nature is dangerous, though, and after you collect DNA, you'll roll a die that may give you other benefits like special DNA, but might also result in a wildlife attack, injuring your gnomon that you place there. You may also send your workers to urban areas and purchase the DNA you need on the black market or perform other actions, including trading DNA, gathering creature blueprints from the basement, which is a market of cards available to all players, or creating the creatures by turning in the DNA indicated on the blueprint cards, which gives the players reputation, this game's version of victory points. Players will take turns in turn order until they run out of workers and passed. The game ends after four rounds or at the end of any round where players created seven creatures. After adding points from achievements to their score, the player with the most reputation wins the game. There are several other mechanisms that we may cover in our discussion, but that should give you a good idea how the game plays. Biohack was designed by Yofiandi Indrayani with art by Tasuki Asano and Iqbal Ridzuan, and published by Uchipikoya out of Japan. All right, so this was my first play, I think Chris's first play tonight, but Adam, I think, has had a chance to play this once or twice because he has a Kickstarter version of this. What do you guys think of the gameplay and mechanisms of Biohack?
There was some interesting stuff going on here. In a lot of ways, this game was a fairly streamlined resource management game, but there were definitely some interesting twists and turns. I think the thing that I found most interesting was how during the course of the round, you had three workers. Your three workers were going to be used for two different things. You're going to put them out in individual spots, pull them back, and then put them out on a set of spots over on the other side of the board. In that sense, it almost felt a little bit like viticulture. I'm saying that very loosely about viticulture because in that one, there's actually set seasons, but you're kind of looking at two different sides of the board that accomplish more or less different things. In this case, you get to pull a worker back and then put them out on the other side of the board. And so you don't have to wait for another phase of the game, but it accomplishes sort of that same experience. But the cool thing is when you're first putting the workers out and that when you initially put them out, and I'm forgetting what that's called. What did they call that? That wasn't the experimentation. It was the
research, I think.
It was the research, yes. So in the research phase of the game, you flip three cards and you put the workers out wherever they happen to be, and you flip them simultaneously. So all three of us were putting our workers out at the same time. And unlike many worker placement games where you're trying to be the only person or the first person or what have you into a spot, you actually want to be in the same spot as other players because the more players are in a spot, then the stronger the action you're going to be taking. So you pull your worker off first and then you score it based on whoever is left on that spot. And it can make a huge difference. So you might be going from taking one resource to getting three or four or five resources, depending on how many players are on that spot. I thought that was actually really cool. I enjoyed that aspect of it. And I don't think it was much like anything I've seen in any other game.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was writing the description, I read the rule book on this and I wrote the description for the game before we played it tonight. And as I was writing the description, I was like, this sounds like five other game descriptions I've written over the last couple of years. It's like, feels like basic worker placement, basic tableau building. I could combine any two or three games and say, this is going to be like a blend of those two. But that worker placement was a lot more interesting than I thought it was going to be because there was an interesting tension between pulling your workers off when there was more grouped there and then using the workers that you had pulled back already to place in the new spaces to try to beat people to bonuses or some of the stronger places in the city or whatever it was called where those variable spaces were. So it was a very interesting tension and I thought a lot more fun than it had any right to be. This game also adds another thing that you could kind of link back to viticulture. In viticulture, it's the wake-up track where when you pick your turn order, you kind of pick how early in the turn you want to go and you get a bonus. The earlier you go in the turn, the least valuable the bonus is. This had a similar mechanism here, which was kind of fun, but you could trigger that not only depending on when you pulled back at the end of the round, but there are a couple of bonus spaces you could take during the course of the round that would let you kind of move your turn order marker earlier in the round and pick what bonus you were going to get early as well as your turn order space. But that's always a fun decision for me. The Fox experiment did that as well. But I really like when turn order isn't just straight, going first is always best. Here, sometimes I was taking that space, getting the bonus, and actually choosing a later turn space just to get the better bonus for it. And I think that's a cool decision in any game.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of ground to cover here, but I want to sort of recap a little bit. We had the left side of the board, those public spaces. That's where everybody's workers are going to start out. There's going to be groups of them, either at the hospital or the mountain or the river. You're going to be sort of collecting resource. The more workers that are in one area, when you pull them back, you get more stuff. So if you have a single guy in one of these spots, you're probably just leaving him there to dangle. You're not too worried about him. But you want to pull your worker from the crowded areas, get all that good stuff. Then you have to decide, are you going to move him when it comes back around to your turn again? Are you going to move that worker that's on your board that you pulled back over to the private spaces, the fun spaces, I guess. There's that downtown area Tim mentioned that has this variable spots every time. Only one gnomon can go there per space, and they're pretty powerful. A lot of good bonuses there. So that's fun to go there. But then, oh, shoot, do I have enough resources? I want to go to the biofarm and get that bonus and build my two guys. And that's going to give me some monsters on my player board. A little tableau, an interesting tableau, something kind of like Wingspan, Worm Spanish, where you're filling in cards. But as you put cards down, that's going to give you bonus. And the cards themselves are going to help you engine build or give you discounts on future builds. So a lot of this has to do with the order that you're going to do things. So I thought that was an interesting piece. Almost everything in this game is order of operations. What are you going to do first? What are you going to do second? What's the smartest way to do it? And there wasn't too much blocking out either. Those are some of the highlights for me in this game. I enjoyed there wasn't too much blocking out, and I really liked trying to decide the best order to do things in.
I keep sort of straying into, I felt like I was playing Viticulture because of, and then nothing about this game actually felt like Viticulture. That's the funny thing. It's like so thematically removed from it, and I didn't actually feel that way. But as you're talking about the not blocking people out, that's true. But it's also true that even though you may not be able to block me from a space that I want to go to, you can block me from getting a really rad benefit at that spot. So they're at the main spots over on the experiment side.
Yeah,
there is a basic, like an unrestricted area you can go to with any of your workers, your gnomon. I don't know why they're called gnomon, but they're called gnomon, your workers, and anybody can put their gnomon in a space. But there's also, for each of those, there was one or two spaces that also came with a benefit. And some of these benefits were pretty huge. It's kind of like, you know, Viticulture again, where maybe you can do two things instead of one thing, or, you know, what have you. And here, they were even bigger than that. So there were spaces where you got a chance to put yourself in a spot of your choice on your turn order for the next round. Or there may be take a free card from the market, or, you know, any number of things like that. Actually, I'll pause there for a second, because one of the most important things was completely blockable. And that was getting what's called the feral DNA. The feral DNA was a wild, but it was also required for certain beasts. So there were some situations where you had to have feral DNA, and at least it was a wild. And so these were huge. I mean, these were incredibly important things to get. And really, there was only one reliable way to get them. And that was by going to this one blockable spot in one of the experiment phase areas. So if you could block that out, or if you were the first to get there, then that was a huge thing. And in fact, the couple of times when I really made an effort to be the first player, it was because I knew I wanted to go to that spot, because I had a particular beast that I wanted to work on that required feral DNA. Now, Tim mentioned at one point that he didn't really need the first player that much, because there was a couple of rounds where Adam and I were going to do things that were entirely different than he did. And so it really kind of depends on your strategy. So it may make a difference, or it may not make a difference. And in fact, one of the things that I found myself questioning whether or not I wanted the first player was because of those changeable downtown spaces. So those were also incredibly powerful. I mean, those were really exciting spaces to see revealed. And each round, you get a whole new set. And I was actually like holding my breath, like, what's going to come up this time? Is it going to be something awesome? Especially if I'm the first player. I would get the first player token, hoping that something good was going to come up in that downtown row that would make the first player token worthwhile, even if I didn't already have something in mind that I wanted to use it for.
There's a couple things you guys said I want to get back to, but one of them is the feral DNA that Chris was talking about. And one of the ways to get it was to go to this one, you know, worker placement space and get a bonus. But here's the other way you got it, and the main way you got it, and that's when you went to a couple of these spaces out in the, or no, the mountains, or the
mountain and the river.
The river, yeah. So these two spaces you go, and this is how you're going to get some certain types of animal DNA. But there is an extra risk that came with them as well, and that is that you have to roll this danger die, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And the danger die could give you that feral DNA. That was the only other way you could get it, other than spending your medicine for it on that one worker placement space Chris was talking about. But it could also kill one of your androids, or basically it knocks them out and makes them unusable until you spend medicine to wake them up. I was pretty frustrated by that die tonight. Now, Chris won pretty handily, and it may be to some extent that every single time he rolled that die, he just got a straight up positive benefit of a feral DNA. Where I rolled it, re-rolled it, re-rolled it, because you can spend money or resource like DNA to re-roll it. But I re-rolled it four times one time and still lost the guy to it. I never got only positive benefit on there. It was fine, but I don't know why you had to add that level of shift in the randomness, like either super positive benefit or super negative, couple things in between. But yuck, that didn't feel good when you're on the receiving end of a dead gnomon.
Tim, all you had to do was get medicine and be the first one to the alley spot. You didn't have to worry about rolling that dice. That's all you had to do.
Yeah. Well, instead, I ended up going to get medicine to heal all my gnomon that were laying in the bottom of my hospital bed or something because they kept getting knocked out. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to circle back to was one of the things that Adam said is that the worker placement spaces, you're not blocked too much. Yeah, there are some bonuses you can get, but the key actions you got to do in this game, you don't get blocked out of. I'm not sure that's a positive. I know it's a positive for Adam, but I do prefer worker placement that is super tight, that every decision is so critical. So it did matter when you went in your turn order and that there, that had some conflict here, but it wasn't quite as tight as I really like worker placement. So I would say from that perspective, the worker placement was just a little bit friendlier than I would prefer.
Well, I do like the friendly worker placement. I thought the game was resource tight, for, at least for me. For Chris, he was able to do everything he wanted to do. And a lot of that has to do with comboing up your initial science pick and your initial creature pick. So I want to talk about this creature market down there. You kind of have your basic cards that sort of add some engine building or increase the value of certain spots. Then you have your mid-level, your mid-tier cards, and those typically provide a discount for building other cards. So maybe you want to go after those first, and then I'll get you discounts for building all these other cards. And then you have your top tier, your hardest to build creatures. They usually cost some of those feral genes. And those add in-game bonus, or sometimes just straight up points. Typhon here, for instance, give you 10 points. But you've also got Minokawa that gives you 3 points for every card that required some sort of, I don't know, buzzard head DNA or whatever that, I'm sure there's a name for it. So interesting choices here on, you know, which cards are you going to go for? What order are you going to build those in? If I was going to go back, I'd probably try to do some of these ones that give you discount on building other cards. Anyway, I'd like this card market of the three tiers of cards. And then your tableau only has room for the cheapies, I guess, but not necessarily cheap. Three of the mid-level and two of those in-game scoring ones. So I thought that was a neat kind of layout too. So you only get to pick two of those in-game scoring cards, and hopefully you get them both in there, because that's a big chunk of points, at least it was for Chris. So what do you guys think about the card market here?
I thought it was cool. I found the engine building in this game to be so satisfying, and part of that was because so much of it was very straightforward. There wasn't that much nuance to it. It was like, if you figured out what you wanted to do and you were able to get the cards to do it, then you went and did it. Like those, in particular, the mid-level cards that give you a discount on other cards, I felt like I was able to really capitalize on that because I had the mammalologist, whatever they call it, the person who was into mammals. And so I got a discount in mammals automatically. Plus, I was able to, in my first round, build up for this really huge elephant-looking dude who gave me a discount of 4 mammal DNAs on every purchase I made after that. And then I was able to get another mammal that gave me a discount of 1 feral DNA. And so every time I bought anything after that, I was getting a discount of 4 mammal DNA and a feral DNA. And so I was getting things for almost nothing. So that made it so much easier to proceed. And I recognized that that wasn't entirely skill. I mean, that was, you know, the things that came out in the card row, and it was pretty mammal heavy at the beginning of the game. So I was very fortunate in that sense. But being able to do that, it just felt so good. It felt so satisfying. And that's not even to mention the little first row cards, the bottom row cards that give you those little benefits on it, like a dollar or a discount on a spot, on a worker placement spot. So I thought it was delightful. I enjoyed it a lot. And, you know, I'm actually really interested to see other cards that are in there and how they kind of varied and how they differed.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. I think there's not going to be that drastic a variety because, like you said, all the mid-level ones just gave discounts. The top-level ones gave you some minor benefit on, and the, you know, on a space that you spend a work or two. And that was probably the most interesting things because those seem more varied. And then the bottom ones were just scoring ones. So I don't think you're going to see a ton of variety if you repeat play this. And in a lot of ways, this reminded me of another tableau builder, and that's Splendor. And the idea that as you build cards, you're just getting essentially free resources for other cards. And so those middle level ones kind of just worked like your Splendor engine, which wasn't bad. Chris clearly did exactly what you're supposed to do with this game, which is look at the starting state, because you get to draft your scientist, look at what's out in the market that you're going to be trying to build, and then look at what the rewards are, the bonuses, and you make those early choices based on those and try to capitalize on them. Sometimes it's going to work because the right cards come up in the market. Sometimes it's not. But that's where the fun of this game is, just trying to put that puzzle together and race other people for the pieces that you think you need. Pretty fun. Now, as far as a tableau builder, the other one that Chris mentioned briefly, or Adam did, was Wingspan and Wormspan. And there's just two points I wanted to make about that comparison, because I think it's a pretty good comparison. The first is that the variation in the cards here is a little bit less interesting, and you don't get to kind of like run your engine like you do in those games once you've built your tableau. But the interaction is much higher. So I think one of the things that this did is it gave you a similar tableau builder with a little less variety in those cards, but the excitement comes from actually interacting and racing with the other players in the worker placement. So I think it's a good comparison. If you like those games, you probably enjoy this too. But if you don't like those because they're not interactive enough, they're really too solitaire, this might be a better fit for you while providing some of that same tableau experience.
Yeah, I think the iconography here, if I guess we're getting into production a little bit, but the iconography here was pretty crisp, and it's easy, very easy to identify what type of engine you want to build and how to execute that, which Chris recognized that right away and put the pieces together. So that was pretty cool to see. I do like the little bonuses, sort of like Worm Span. For a few of the spots on your player board have these bonuses for putting cards down on them. And then there's an A side and B side for that. So another little way to mix it up when you're playing the game, as far as that goes. I'm just looking at the B side here. So a lot more bonuses on the B side. Not a lot more, just different in different spots. So that will mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, would probably motivate you maybe to focus on like the top row cards versus middle row cards a little bit. And it would give you a different reason to go after some of those things than you would have on the A side.
Exactly. Yeah. One thing that was a little, I don't know, a little funky in practice was your DNA tracker for me. So this goes into production again a little bit too here. So you have these five DNA on this little track, and they're kind of cylinders. So you're moving those up and down and kind of handling those. We're on TTS tonight, but in real life too, you might bonk into this one and knock it over. Oh crap, did I have two or did I have three DNA? Now I can't remember. Shoot. I think it was at two. I don't know. That's not the best system for tracking, so that can be a little awkward when we're going there. But sorry, that's a production thing. Anything else you guys want to talk about mechanism wise?
I guess the only thing I'd add that we didn't really get into was the, I don't know what you call them, the goals. There was two sets of goals on the board. One of them was filling up your rows. And if you filled up your rows, then you got to automatically put a token down and claim a certain number of points. And each person that claimed that same reward after you did, and anybody could claim it, but you got less points depending on where you were in the order of who claimed it. There was another spot, I don't know what it's called, but it's like the star track. There was like a set of stars achievements. And it did the same thing where you got to put your tokens out there and you scored based on whether you were the first, second, third, what have you. But for that one, you actually had to take a special action in order to put your token out there. I have to admit, it was probably the right choice design-wise, but I didn't like it because you had to take that action to do it. And so I actually met the requirements for all four of those different achievements, but I wasn't able to claim them because I didn't have the actions to spend to do it. Like I said, probably the right design choice, but it felt a little less fun. It might have felt too permissive if you didn't have to do that, though.
Well, one of the interesting things about that action to take that thing was also where you would unlock your scientist abilities. So I think the fun thing is trying to get to a point where you at least have met one of the achievements, try to race to that, then hit at the same time you're going to unlock your scientist abilities, and then you're not wasting an action. Because I went to that space twice and just unlocked scientist abilities. And so there is an interesting like part of that, you know, puzzle there. But yeah, I hear what you're saying, Chris, because you do have to give something up in order to get the benefit.
So now if you get the right cards and you get your engine running and you're able to lay out all these cards out there like Chris was doing, is there a runaway leader issue? I know we've only played this game once, but was Chris catchable this game? Or if we would go back and play it, would we do things to counter what Chris had going on?
No, Chris was completely uncatchable. Completely uncatchable.
No, I think it's a great question, Adam, but I don't think that was the problem, because he ended up like 20 points above me and like 25 points above you or something like that. So it wasn't in a 140 point game. It wasn't that big of a lead. And I don't think the problem was that Chris built his cards fastest, because he did that well, but he was smart enough to pay attention to the type of cards he was building based on his end game goals. He also managed to double down by getting a second. He got one of the scoring monsters that also cared about that same type of card. So he basically got like 24 points for that one scoring monster and then doubled it with like 22 points for his scientist. So we could have potentially tried to take that out of the market knowing that he was going for that. Or, you know, we both could have played better. You know, I don't think either of us really looked when we picked our scientists at the beginning. We didn't even look at the achievements that are around the board. I drafted two monsters that didn't even go with anything else on my board just because they look cool to start with. So, you know, I don't think that even with him seeming to have a runaway game, he was only like 20 points up on us at the end. So I don't know that it's a major issue. But, you know, late engine builders like this are going to be like that too, though. You're going to build your engine well and you're going to do better than everyone else. And so it's not a super heavy game that you have to worry too much about. That's how I feel about it anyway. Well, let's jump into the production and theme on Biohack.
I really deeply enjoyed the production on this game. The art was, I'm trying to think of the right way to describe the experience of playing this game. So it was weird in the best possible way. The art was this kind of eerie, cartoony, yet kind of dark and creepy sort of thing. You had these, it reminded me a little bit of Alien with these weird eggs that people were incubating in, these monsters. The monsters were this incredible collection of, I think it was mostly mythological creatures from all over the world. I'm not that much of a student of world mythology, but it looked like they came from different regions. They had names from different regions. And that to me was kind of an interesting choice because, you know, if you're just making random bio sliced, hacked, whatever monsters, how do they all end up being these odd mythological things? But there was all these little design choices that to me, like, I have no idea where they came from, but they all came together to create this really creepy, immersive experience. Like, there were these guys, you're gnomon, they're androids, but they're wearing trench coats and suits and ties and wear glasses. I don't know why that strikes me as so creepy, but it did. It's like, you know, this is robot, but he's like wearing a suit and wearing glasses. And it reminded me of, do you guys remember that movie from, I don't know, must be a couple decades ago. There was Frank Miller's Sin City.
Yeah, totally.
It kind of reminded me of that kind of a feel to it, like this weird, creepy, things are a little bit off, almost like a Blade Runner-ish kind of vibe to it. So, I mean, this could have gone in a million different ways. It could have been cartoony and funny, or it could have been cartoony and cute. But this one, at least to me, felt like it went dark. And I really liked that. It made me feel like if this was a more sort of neutral tone, I would have walked away saying it was a fun game to play, but it didn't leave that much of an impression on me. As it stands, I walked away going, that was a creepy but fun experience. And so that it definitely left a production impression on me.
Yeah, I think the production theme here is where this game really shines. Mechanically, you know, it had some fun stuff going on, but it wasn't really groundbreaking. But they put such a cool theme on this. And it starts right off, the rulebook has like a 2-page story entry that's kind of like tells a story of, you know, the scientist that was doing unethical stuff, and someone went to arrest him because they found human tissue in one of his experiments, and he disappeared. And then there's a house fire and it burns down. It turns out they found his body and also some of his old experiments. And now you're his old lab technicians coming back. It just tells a really great story. And the storybook lays it out in a story type of mode. And then you're playing with these creepy androids, like Chris said, and this really cool. Now, the artwork is one thing, though, that I want to ask you guys about, because at a glance, it looks awesome. It's very neat. They're very cool monsters. But there was a couple of them that gave me the sense that these could have been maybe even AI generated, just because there was a little bit of fuzziness to them in a way that you tend to see those. I could be totally wrong about that. There's clearly artists represented here, but a couple of them just felt a little bit on the generic side. And, you know, like they weren't really artistically created. They were kind of fuzzily put together. I don't know if that's true. The mermaid, for example, was the one that really caught me off like that. The face on the mermaid, it had no detail to it. It was this kind of fuzzy. I don't know. What did you guys think about the art? Did you get any sense of that? Or do you feel like it was all just beautiful human created artwork?
I don't know, Tim. I don't want to throw like any AI accusations.
I can't. Yeah, I don't. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it at least reminded me of what I'm seeing in AI right now. It doesn't mean that it is. And some of that stuff is beautiful too. I just got that little sense that it was very, like, I'm looking at the Sumish card online right now. It's this little like hamster with bird wings on it. And there's something about the shading and the color tone stuff that just give me that little feel. But again, this could be someone's, you know, awesome hand-painted artwork as well. So that was the only thing that turned me off, because like at a glance, it was all like, these are so cool. And then I started to get some of that fuzziness to it, where it's just a little hint of like, did somebody actually put the, I don't know. I don't, you know, I won't go down that path anymore. Did you like the artwork, Adam?
The artwork in production is what drew me in the first place and what was eye-catching to me. So I love the artwork here. And then, you know, I looked at it further and it looked like a decent game, a little Tableau engine builder. So that's what drew me into the Kickstarter initially. As far as the shading, I like all the mythical monsters, the theme here. You got like a merlion, half lion, half fish, half goldfish or koi fish, something. So it's just kind of wacky, goofy, dark, like Chris said, but not overly goofy. I mean, it could be goofy. Like looking at that Sumesh little flying hamster guy, he's holding a little nut flying around. So there is like a little bit of sense of humor here, which is great, but it's all in this dark backdrop, this kind of eerie world, like Chris is saying. I love how the game board looks. It's this sort of 3D zoomed in perspective of this crazy little town where you have these different buildings that are out there with this sort of neon, this sort of cyberpunk almost style to it, which is pretty. So yeah, that's kind of what drew me in the first place, is the whole aesthetic of this game. So as far as artwork is concerned, I love it. And I don't know, I'm not bold enough to say anything about AI.
I don't know anything about what distinguishes AI artwork. I'm not sure I could ever tell. But here's why I think that probably isn't true, other than the fact that you actually have credited artists here. But like, I'll use the mermaid for an example. The mermaid here is not what you traditionally think of as a mermaid. It's this creepy fish looking. Actually, I mentioned it during the game that it doesn't look like what I would normally think of as a mermaid. It looks like the mermaid from Cabin in the Woods, which is, I guess, my second or third movie reference tonight, where it was kind of grotesque, not exactly attractive. And so if I just said to AI, draw me a mermaid, probably wouldn't look like this. Oh, and here I'll make one more old pop culture reference. The board has this overhead three-quarter view, just like the old video game Zaxxon. Bam.
I love the art. I thought the board artwork was great. It's kind of like a cyberpunk future crowded seaport city or something like that. Very, very cool style. Lots of neon going on here. Yeah, really, I think the production here is amazing. And I think the theme that they went along with on this is very cool as well. Adam, you mentioned the resource tracker, and I'm glad that they use that instead of you having to collect a ton of little components, a bunch of little resources, but it would have benefited from a dual layer player board. And like DeVere has been doing that with their tracking resource on the White Castle, for example, is a little board that, you know, it's just tracks that you use to track them, but it's all, you know, you insert them in, so it stays together a little bit better. This one, you're right, it was like 6 tokens or 7 tokens, and it was very easy to bump them and jostle them. So a little, you know, a little tougher there, but I still think it's better than, like, I'll always go with tracks over just collecting tons of resources.
Yeah, minor gripe here, but yeah, you have these tall kind of cylinders, right? So they kind of get in the way of each other. If you're going for the one on the right side, you might bump the one on the left side as you're moving your hand over there. So it's just a tiny little gripe, but a little bit awkward. You have to really be careful and, you know, do like one of those claw things that you can never grab the toy with, but you grab your cylinders and move it up and then move your hand back up and grab the other one and move that up. So you have to be just have some finesse when you're working with the DNA trackers here. Also, I want to talk about the reduction a little more. It came, I had the Kickstarter version here. It came with some nice metal coins. I don't know if that's standard. I can't remember if there was any punchy-outy. I think there was some punchy-outy cardboard coins in there, but the metal coins are great. The components, the standard medicine, little wood things that you flip over, full or empty, is cool. The danger die is pretty neat, little custom die, all different little faces on there, fun little graphics. First player token, just a wooden circle with the same aesthetic. There's some little bit of tentacles going on here with the mad scientist on that, so that's funny, but just very impactful art. Oh, one little nick on the production again, there's a light blue and a dark blue, and those two colors, they're very dissimilar. It's easy to distinguish with the DNA tracker, and they put a little icon on it. That's, some of those icons are hard to tell apart, but going from the DNA trackers themselves to the icons on the cards and on the board, there's another color mismatch there. So even more tones of blue as you're going from icon to DNA tracker. So that is a little frustrating. You have to make sure you're getting the right one. And more than once have I mixed that up during my first play here as I was going through it on the table.
And I think that was the only real complaint I had about the production at all, was that the fish and the bird DNA were almost identical. I think I screwed up a whole turn because I miscalculated, because I thought I had one, but I actually had the other. So, but other than that, no complaints at all.
Well, you clearly needed a handicap in this game anyway, Chris. No, I agree. It definitely was confusing. I like the iconography that they used to represent those DNAs. It was a cool stylized version of a fish and a bird and stuff like that, but it was hard to tell them apart.
Little embryos is what they were.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. All right, cool. Well, let's jump into our final question. And that is, would you request to play Biohack again?
I would request to play Biohack again. I really enjoyed this game. Like I said, it left an impression on me, not just because it played well, but because it told an interesting story and it put me in an interesting world that creeped me out a little bit, but I really enjoyed being there at least for a couple of hours. And one thing, to go back to some comments that you had made earlier, Tim, about the luck in this game, there clearly was more luck to this game than there is in the average resource management. And that came from the dice. It came from the rotating cards. It came from the rotating downtown tiles. But honestly, I like that a lot. I thought it added some really fun, some diversions in there. Like I had such a good time rolling that danger die, probably because I kept doing well with it. But, you know, it was a little bit of a thrill every time I rolled it. So I had a lot of fun doing that. The only caveat that I'll say about this game, I do see how this could get pretty repetitive on multiple plays if you were playing it in a short period of time. So I think this is a kind of game that, you know, it certainly could, you know, for the amount that we would likely play any given game, I think it could survive. But if as a game that you play over and over again, I think it would get a little bit samey. But I had a really good time playing it, and I would happily play it again.
Yeah, my feelings match up pretty well here. The light engine builders, they never quite hit my expectations for them. And this one, I think probably the thing that pushes it over the top and makes me want to revisit it is the theme and the production. I thought it was a cool world to spend a little time in, a cool concept of going out and collecting this DNA and turning it into monsters. It was just fun to do that. And the mechanisms were pretty fun. Good interaction in here that I think was worth exploring a bit more. I'm not sure how it would hold up over multiple plays, but I'm not sure that it wouldn't either, because I think even if you get to know it and you start to understand what your opponents are going for, there's good opportunities to get in the way, or take advantage of the fact that you know that they want that DNA to build that thing. So I'll go to that space and get some extra bonuses because I'm going there. So I think this game is worth at least revisiting and then seeing if it's something that is even more fun on subsequent plays.
I'm with you guys. Nothing earth-shattering here other than an awesome theme on a pretty cool engine tableau builder. So that's something I've been searching for years, and they finally delivered it here. Nice production, nice theme, fun engine building, cool cards, fun little monsters. I think even a little bit of sense of humor here, which is nice. That danger die, I loved it too, Chris. I like that sense of a little bit of randomness and like, oh, I got the feral DNA I was wanting to get, or oh, I busted again. How am I going to manage my injured little android gnomon here? So I have this one. I'm going to go back to it multiple times. We'll see if it holds up. I hope so.
Cool. Well, that'll wrap up the conversation on Biohack. And we'll jump into some games that have been on our table right after this. Welcome back. What have you guys been playing this week?
So last week, I had the opportunity to play a game that you guys have talked about a couple times at least, but I had not played, and that is Camel Up. What a fun game that is. I didn't really know much about it other than what you guys had told me. And I have a friend who has a copy of it, and we were just hanging around at his house. And I saw it sitting there, and I said, hey, let's play that. That's a game that I'm interested in trying out. I've heard about it, but I haven't actually tried it. And I understand it to be kind of a light, fun racing betting game. And so we busted it out. There was three of us and had just an absolute blast of a time. For those who haven't played it, I won't get into a great deal of detail on the rules. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. There are these multicolored camels that are going out on this track, and you're trying to get them all the way around the track one time. You do that by playing cards that might move them, or by rolling dice and that might move them. And each one is going to move a different colored camel a certain number of spaces. And you don't own any of the camels. All you're doing is betting on which camel you think is going to win. And you have different ways that you can bet who's going to come in first, who's going to come in last. But really, it's all about, you know, kind of anticipating who's going to be the winner, who's going to be the loser. But where this game gets goofy and funny is as the camels land on the same space, they don't just occupy the same space, but they pile up on top of each other. So you may have a stack of four or five camels. All of a sudden, it's a, you know, anybody's race because they're all moving together, but whoever's on top, who's sitting on the top of that pile, is getting pulled along with the rest of them. And then you're trying to separate them out so that, yeah, just it's wacky fun. And then on top of all of that, you've got these two wild camels, a black and a white camel, that are going the opposite direction. So if your camels land on top of one of these wild camels, they're going to start going backwards now instead of going forward. So there's just all kinds of goofy things happening. Lots of fun, simple rule set, quick game. I think we played a full game of this in maybe half an hour and just had a blast of a time. Also family friendly. There's a light rule set that you could teach to even younger players, and it's got a great production, which would be appealing to younger players as well. You have big chunky camel minis, kind of stylized. Even the board itself has this pop-up palm tree that comes out, and it just looks really neat, really cool, fun little hooting and hollering kind of game. As people get the camels moving in the right direction and people start winning or losing bets, you hear a lot of hooting and hollering in celebration or in despair if you bet wrong. Definitely recommend this one. I had a great time playing it, and looking forward to playing this one again. And we actually, at the end of that game night, it was getting kind of late, but we wanted to play one more quick game, and my buddy busted out Sorry. So we played a game of Sorry, and there's no classic board game that I enjoy quite as much as Sorry. I just think that is some brutal, brutal fun. And mean.
That's
brutal and mean.
That's funny, Chris, because, you know, as my daughter, you know, we had some family games, people gifted them to us, you know, kind of traditional family big box games. And Sorry is the one that if my daughter was ever going to play a game, I was like, can we please play Sorry? That was my favorite game growing up. I still enjoy it, even though there's not a whole lot of agency in it, but it is a little bit of fun choices. And it's one that I don't mind sitting through just an activity and having a fun time when somebody busts the Sorry card out right as somebody's about to send their last person into home. So yeah, I'm on board with you. Glad you had fun with Camel Up. My favorite part of that is that you blindly are getting bet on which camel it is. And the sooner you bet, mm-hmm. the bigger the amount you can win. But if you bet wrong, you're going to lose money on it. So it's a tricky decision as to when you actually start betting. And if you bet, the other people go in think you're, and you know, they may not know what you're betting for. So it's fun to turn over those cards at the end and see who actually bet and who, you know, who actually won for getting the right, guessing the right camel across. I think I like Downforce just a little bit more for a similar light racing betting game, but Camel Up's pretty good. Adam, you have never played this, have you?
No, I remember you guys talking about this, or I remember you talking about this before, Tim, and hearing Chris talk about it again makes me want to go back to this and give this one a shot. It looks wacky and fun.
It's a fun one.
And it definitely feels to me like a heavier game than Downforce. Downforce is not by any means a heavy game. I'd say this one is a pretty light game.
Cool. Well, a game I got on the table this week is actually in the top 100 on Board Game Geek, one of the few games that I had not played prior to this. And this was Le Havre by designer Uwe Rosenberg. This was published by Lookout Games. This is a very interesting, I think it was his design that he published right after Agricola. And it's interesting because I'm going to compare a couple mechanisms here. Le Havre is a worker placement game with accumulation spaces, but it doesn't feel anything like Agricola or any traditional worker placement. The way this works is that there is a basically seven spaces in the middle of the board. And those seven spaces essentially represent turns in a round. And you're going to play this game in a three-player game, for example, you play over 18 rounds. But it's as simple as this. The first player moves their boat onto the first space on these seven markers. And that space is going to tell you what goods get populated in an accumulation space. So all those are really doing is marking how many turns there are in the round, but also which accumulation spaces are going to build up on that turn. So there's like eight basic resources in the game. And let's say the first space you move to, it puts a money and a fish out on the board. So at the start of the game, there's already two money and two fish there. So now you've got a juicy space with three money in it or three fish. Or you could take the one space that's further down that still only has two wood in it because the game started out that way. But there's nothing in the iron space. So the next person goes, I'll get to what you actually do on your turn. But the next person's turn, they'll just move to the next space in that row. You know, they don't have any choices. That's just what's going to happen. But it just tells you what gets put on the board. So the next space might just put an iron out on the board. Now there's only one iron there, but iron's very rare. There's only one that comes up every round. So you could choose to pick up that iron. Now on your turn, what you're actually doing after you move your boat and the accumulation spaces fill, you either just take all the stuff off one of those accumulation spaces, or you use your worker to go to a building. And this gets really interesting because first of all, just like in Agricola, those accumulation spaces are going to change what you want to do. Like you may not even want any fish, but when there's eight fish sitting on that space, you got to take the eight fish, right? But this is all, it's like seven different accumulation spaces. So there's just tons of things that are piling up over the course of the game at different levels. So some of them come up more frequently than others. So it creates really fun tension. But the other thing you can do is you've got one worker and you can place it on a building. So at the start of the game, there's only three buildings available and all three of them do the same action. They let you build another building. And then there's this market of buildings. There's always three visible. And so you can pay the resource cost on one of those buildings and then build it into your tableau. And what that building does is it might create, you know, give you resources if you use it or somebody else uses it. But a lot of what those buildings do is they're starting to let you convert those resources into upgraded resources or turning upgraded resources into points, for example. I mentioned there's eight basic resources. These are all tiles that have a thing on them. So one of them is fish. Well, if you upgrade that tile, if you get the smokehouse, you can turn in fish, flip them over, and now they're smoked fish. And they create more food because, of course, you have to feed your people at the end of every round. So you got to be creating food while you're creating the resources that you're trying to convert to points.
Tim, you just lost me.
and then these buildings are cool because when you use them, some of them will just straight up do conversions. But usually when you do conversions, you might get half a coin for each conversion you do. So if you can convert four things, you'll get two coins. Well, coins are points at the end of the game as well. Fun choices of trying to build up enough stuff that before you start to convert it, you get more benefits. But some of the conversions cost energy. And so some of the resource types you've got actually have little energy icons on it. For example, the wood, which is a pretty basic resource that you use for building, but it also can be turned in for an energy. So if you want to, for example, convert hide into leather, you also have to pay half an energy for every one that you convert. So you have to turn in other goods aside from the ones you're converting. So you just get to build it. And there's something like 30 buildings in a three-player game that eventually get built. Now, you can build them in your tableau, and then you can use them. But if somebody else wants to use them, there's a little cost that they have to pay you. And it can be a variety. Maybe they have to pay you two food or they have to pay you a coin, which is a point. Also, at the end of the game, these buildings you're building are all worth points as well. So you're trying to build the buildings while you're collecting resources. The worker placement thing's interesting because if you put your marker on a worker placement space and then the next four turns, all you do is grab accumulation spaces, you've left your worker there and you've blocked it from anyone else using it. So it's got a good tension in the worker placement. Like, oh, he just went there and I might not get to use it for three rounds because he's blocking it. Now I got to figure out a different strategy to focus on the next few runs. Guys, this game is fantastic. It is so simple to get into and start playing. I played with a local friend and then we busted out again a week later and invited my wife to play with us. And I taught it in 5 minutes. We were in and playing it and she loved it too. This game is so fun. Every choice is a fun choice, but there is that tension of having to make sure you didn't forget to get enough resources to feed your people. And you only get like 2 turns per round, maybe 3 turns per round. It is very short. You have to be planning, but you're starting to build up this engine where it's automatically feeding people. So in a lot of ways, it feels a bit like Agricola, but it's a lot more straightforward than Agricola. And it's just got so much more of those accumulation spaces you're planning for. I absolutely love this game. I am 100% buying it. I think this is a game that I will go back to indefinitely and will always have fun playing this. So Le Havre was a much bigger hit than I expected it to be.
I think Adam is completely engrossed at the thought of this game.
Well, Tim, I have a question. What would you say the complexity rating is on this one?
Well, I would have rated it probably about a 3. I'm looking at the BGG page. So they're saying 3.72. I don't think that's accurate. I wonder if it's just because the game's been around a long time and so it's got it's higher on the curve from our earlier games.
Okay.
I don't feel like it was a 3.72 at all. I would rate it like a 3.25 maybe max.
Okay. Yeah, because the way you're talking about it, it sounds like it's easy to get into. It sounds like it does sound like a game I would love. As much as I gave you heat about having to feed your people, I don't know. That could be frustrating, but maybe not. The way you describe it, it sounds super fun.
I think you'd like it, Adam, even if it does have some of those things you don't like in some games. I think this one was just kind of light and quirky and fun choices every time that I think you actually would enjoy it. I played it at 2 players and 3 players, and it played great at both. I thought it even got more interesting at 3. Even 2 was fun. This might be one of these classic games that I think it's worth it for us just to do a feature review on at some point, because I liked it so much and I think you guys would like it so much that I would love to introduce it to you. So I dug it. What do you think, Chris? Want to revisit a Rosenberg game?
Yeah, no, I think that I'd be willing to try this one. I'm getting kind of this combination of like Keyflower, Yokohama, and Agricola, which is probably wrong, but, and I, what would you call that?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Key Gricolama.
Yeah, I can see that, because like Keyflower, where you're bidding out, you're basically taking these buildings and then other people have to pay you to use them. It does have some of that element to it. So I would say it definitely, you know, it feels like an old school Euro. I don't know, there's something about actually some of the Euros of this age that are interactive enough and light enough. They're easy to get into, but they actually create fun decisions while you're managing your resources and feeding your people. So yeah, I liked it. I think you guys would pick it. I think you'd have a fun time with it.
Very cool. Well, on my table has been another Kickstarter game that arrived recently, Skyrise. This one's by Gavin Brown, Sebastian Pochon, and Adam Wise, with art by Andrew Bosley, published by Roxley. So let me talk about the production really quick. It's a Roxley game. They have a very high standard of production, and they don't miss here either. There's all these buildings, and they have a wash on them, so 4 different colors of 3 tiers of building. And it's beautiful. The game board is extravagant as well. It's this allegedly cloud city, all these fans. Like, imagine a drone. One of the things with the cameras that fly around zzz, and are all annoying.
Drone.
Imagine a giant drone, but with a city on it, you know, big enough to hold a city and all these different neighborhoods. So that's what this is. We're architects. We have all these buildings in our color. Everybody has different numbers ranging from 1 to like 114. And there's kind of 2 phases of this game. So in the first phase, you only use about half your buildings. You start this little auction. So Chris starts with a building. Oh, I'm going to build a 15 here in the middle. And then Tim goes, well, I got to bid next to the person that bid previously. So I'm going to put my 17 here. Well, I'm going to jump up with my 60 right next to this one. So you have this little snaky auction going around, and you can force people to use their higher buildings if you want to. So I'm looking over at Chris. Oh, he only has a 74, or his next highest one is a 95. I'm going to use my 75 and force him to use his 95. Is he going to do it or not? You're going around with this sort of auction that's meandering around the board to these different little neighborhoods. Each little neighborhood has a little token on it. If you win the bid, you get to put your building there, grab a little token off, put that on your player board for some bonuses as that goes on. Everybody who didn't win the bid gets their buildings back. That's basically the rules. You do that and repeat. So once someone builds their last building of the first era, that first set of building, now all the buildings come to the game, including the special wonder building. And that is when you choose one of three powers that that wonder building is going to provide you. And if you're like Chris, like how we played Biohack, you thought ahead of how you want to use that wonder building. And you did all the stuff right in the first half of the game to set up your wonder building for the second half of the game. Or in this case, the way we played the other night, like Sarah did, I played this with Sarah and my dad, and she whooped up on us by like 60 points. It wasn't even close at the end. Anyway, you're doing the same thing. Your wonder building, as soon as you put that down, it's an instant win. So you want to use that effectively, try to get yourself a bunch of points with that one. The game's really neat. You can work yourself this bid, and eventually all these spots get taken up, right? So you have these little neighborhoods, little patches of land where if you win the bid, you can win the next bid with your lowest building because there is no other adjacent spaces. So it can get boxed in. So you want to be smart. You don't want to put a dumb bid in like I did numerous times. So the next person can outbid you, win that one, and then they can just put their little tiny one building in and take that land for free. So you're trying to strategize it out, see how it's going to work out, win this bid. There's also some private and public objectives for scoring. Again, something Sarah paid attention to that I didn't really pay attention to. You want to set those up as the game goes on, force other people to use their buildings. There's a little bit of area majority here with the tallest buildings on each of these little islands. They call them, they say there's like four little islands plus a central island that only has four little neighborhoods on it. A super fun game, a 5-minute rules teach, incredible production, a lot more fun than I was expecting. That's Skyrise by Roxley Games, Gavin Brown, Sebastian Pouchon, and Adam Wise. Big hit for me.
What a table presence on this game, Adam. I want to just sit and look at it. I mean, it sounds like it's fun to play too, but I mean, it looks like an absolute joy to just sit and touch and look at.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. It's beautiful. It's one of the prettiest games that I own.
It's crazy. This what this probably cost you $100 plus, right, for this Kickstarter version?
Let me go check.
Well, it looks like it, based on this, you know, these molded plastic islands and these, you know, washed minis and everything. And it's a light auction game. It sounds absolutely fun, and it sounds like it'd be a great thing to play with this production, but it seems over the top. I did notice that the retail version of this doesn't have those big 3D printed islands, and it has like wooden meeple buildings. And honestly, that's probably the better fit for this game, but I want to play Adam's Kickstarter version with these, with all this crazy, crazy huge components in it and plastic and everything. But the game itself sounds like a blast, to be honest. It sounds like the best of like Reiner Knizia's auctions without the crappy scoring at the end of the rounds that Chris gets annoyed by, which doesn't bother me too much, but it sounds like this would be a little less punishing from that perspective, just a little more fun overall. So I'm excited to play this. I can't wait. Hopefully we get to play this one soon.
Yeah, incredibly approachable, I think. So it costs $96 Canadian, which converted now is about 70 American bucks. One tiny complaint, the Kickstarter version has these islands, these 3D chunky islands. There's little bridges between them that provide adjacency. And I see a lot of people have painted them up. They're easy to overlook if you're not super aware of where they are. So going from one island to the other, you might not notice them. So a lot of people painted up, highlighted those to make the adjacency a little easier. That's my one tiny little production issue. Besides that, the production is pretty flawless.
Sounds great. Did you say you have tried this at two, Adam?
I have not tried it at two.
I would expect this to not be as fun at two as you'd probably want to play it at like three or four, right?
There, I think four would be ideal for this for sure. And there's a couple of variations with two player rules. You get to use two wonder buildings. So you use the other wonder building from the other colors that aren't in play, and you get two wonder cards. So maybe that makes it a little more fun. But yeah, I think the more the merrier with Skyrise here.
This would be a fun one. Maybe we can get Sarah and Danielle to play this when we get a game night in the summer when I'm out living near you.
I bet we could.
That's going to wrap up our On the Table segment today. I do have one quick podcast review that I got from a listener this week. We always appreciate these. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And this is a special one because it's our first Argentinian review.
This was
by Argentinian dude in Argentina. The title was My Number One BG Podcast, 5 stars. As someone fairly new to the hobby, year and a half, I learn a lot from you guys, and I enjoy how different your tastes are in games. It opens up interesting discussions of game design and themes. I'm catching up on all the episodes in a Netflix marathon kind of way. Keep them coming. Okay. Thank you so much. We're almost at 200 episodes right now, so you should have plenty to keep you busy for a little while. It's about 200 hours of podcasts, but we plan to keep releasing them every week, so you should have ways to go as well. Awesome to hear from somebody in South America. Now we've had, I think, a couple Swedish reviews. We've had some UK, Canadian, lots of US, of course, and Argentina. Let's get some more countries in here. So if you're listening to us in another country, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to give you a shout out here.
That's great. I speak a little Spanish. I've been trying to find board game podcasts in Spanish, or, you know, anything, any entertaining podcasts in Spanish. So if you're on Blue Sky or the Facebook, please let me know what other podcasts would be good to listen to. Some of your favorites in Spanish that a not super fluent Spanish speaker could listen to help them get into the language a little more.
Yeah, I'm not bright enough to learn a second language, I don't think. But I do think that we should take our BGG cons on the road and hit up all the different countries that we have listeners in.
That would be awesome.
Absolutely.
There's our retirement plan right there. All right, cool. Well, that will wrap this episode up. If you enjoy the show, you can follow us on Blue Sky as well as our Facebook group. Until next week, take care, everybody.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye.